I think I had a Musar moment on my way here. I would have been here like 5 minutes earlier, but I was so deep in thought about something that I walked all the way down almost to Rachel Imenu instead of turning on Resh Lakish. And I remember we had studied that in one of the previous chapters about being so deep in...
Oh, that's what I wanted to talk to you about, actually. I didn't mean that you should go off the path, We're talking about Reb Simcha Zissel of Kelm, and we emphasized over and over again that what's primary in his Weltanschauung, in his worldview, is thought, is man's intellect. We had last week an entire chapter called Tikkun HaMidos, and in that chapter what we established was that if man has this power of thought, if he can take his seichel and he can upgrade it to the highest level, then he'll be able to overcome all these temptations. Therefore, his program was one of, we'll call it, training, an educational training. And this training requires a person to try to use his intellect as much as possible. There'll always be emotion, but the emotion and the passion comes later. What's primary, what has to begin the process, is the process of thought, of analysis. There's an emphasis here on discipline. You know, if a person's mind is distracted, it means he's not disciplining his capability to think. And therefore, we have to have a training session in which we're constantly thinking. And in Rav Simcha Zissel's frame of reference, tefillah, prayer, becomes a very important training ground. Because the question is, can we focus on the intention of tefillah for a period of time? All sorts of thoughts flood our minds. You know, those powers within us are trying to distract us. And can we overcome them? So that when you are ready to daven, the first thing you should have in mind is, I'm going to train myself to focus, to be in deep thought, and to overcome all these distractions. That again, because das, and because seichel is primary, becomes an excellent training ground for this concept of seichel over what he calls anili atzmi. You remember that last week we discussed the fact that the root of all evil is that man sees himself as the epicenter of the world. What we want to discuss tonight is how Rav Simcha Zissel would create a program in which he could gather together people, young people, who would be focused on this kind of avoda, this kind of service to God, this kind of training in which they would improve themselves and perfect themselves. And this is what's called the Beis HaTalmud. Okay, I'll write that on the board. Beis HaTalmud.
Why the change from Beis HaMusar?
Because this is going to be a full-time program. Beis HaMusar in the past was only a part-time program. It was a place where you would gravitate during any hour of the day. You were basically dedicated to your work, your occupation. You'd find some time, steal away some time, and gravitate towards the Beis HaMusar. It was a place, if you remember, that Rabbi Yisrael created to feel an atmosphere of quiet, of contemplation. But here, in Kelm, what Rav Simcha Zissel is going to create, that is a picture of the building on the front cover of this volume, it's very interesting.
Sure.
He's going to create a structure and a location where people could dedicate themselves full time to the study of Torah. But the emphasis is going to be Torah as part of a program of tikkun hamidos, of hishtalmut, of reaching shlemut, reaching perfection. So therefore he calls it Beis HaTalmud, because our primary focus in learning is going to be the study of the Talmud. But as we're going to soon see, the way he organized the program within the Beis HaTalmud, it's all geared towards a certain goal in the personal development and achievement of greatness. So now, before we go on and get into the details, about this concept of the Beis HaTalmud of Kelm, which was a very unique educational environment and institution, and had very specific goals. That would be the place where Rav Simcha Zissel could take his methodology and apply it in a practical way. I wanted to talk to you for a few minutes about a certain contemporary of Rav Yisrael Salanter, meaning we're going back one generation, and this was an individual called the Chozer. Alright? Now the word Chozer means a seer. And the reason why the Chozer from the city of Lublin was dubbed with this name Chozer is because he was blind. Now, you know the word euphemism. So the euphemism for a blind person is a seer. And they say about the Chozer that even though he was blind, he could see. What does that mean, he could see? He could somehow intuitively perceive things about you and about me that were below the surface. All of man is a combination of what's revealed and what's concealed. What's revealed is what appears to the naked eye, and what's concealed is something below the surface, otherwise known as pnim. Pnim means the face of a person it demonstrates what's inside the person, right? No two people have the same exact features and countenance. The countenance hides something much deeper, which is called the pnimiyut, the inside of a person. So the Chozer was able to somehow, almost miraculously, supernaturally perceive below the surface and see something that you and I couldn't see. And that's how he guided his people.
He had smicha, I'm assuming, like he was...
Big. Really, he was really amongst the giants. But he goes out in history, not because of his Torah knowledge, but because of his ability to influence his flock, his people, because he was able to somehow get down to their neshama, down to their soul, and he would guide each individual in that person's own way. Now, if you know anything about the history of Hasidut, you'll know that there were skeptics. And especially in the case of the Chozer, because the disciples would rave about him, that he had this uncanny ability to see below the surface, there were many skeptics. And they said, no, this is impossible, there's no such thing as a human being who on the one hand is blind, and on the other hand he can tell you and guide you based on your pnimius because he sees below the surface. They didn't accept that. And all the stories that they heard about the Chozer were criticized. And there was a certain skepticism, and people would say, oh, come, it can't be. So many of the stories that you'll hear about the Chozer are about the concept of emunah, of faith. Because people would gravitate towards the Chozer who needed what we call chizuk. They needed strength. They needed consolation. They needed encouragement. They were facing difficult moments in their lives. And they would come and gravitate to the Chozer because he would somehow see to their nefesh and give them a sense of emunah, of faith in God. Now, from the perspective of both Chasidut and Musar, these are the two movements that overlap, the key of all religious life and success in religious life is going to be emunah, is going to be faith. And faith is something that is not only mandated as one of the, if not the most fundamental principle of Judaism, but moreover, it's considered the healer of all healers. Meaning, if a person doesn't have faith, then it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to face the vicissitudes and the challenges of life, the ups and downs of life. We need faith because that belief in God is the only salvation, the only hope. You know, this week we have Purim. Purim is considered a holiday of faith because it tells us that every single event that occurred, that transpired in this, in the history of Megillat Esther, is all part of a divine plan. You know, the people are invited to this banquet, and then Vashti is beheaded, and then there's a story about Bigsan Viseresh, you know, two people who are spying against the king, and then you have a story about Haman who gets elected. You know, every single event unto itself doesn't seem to have any divine supervision. You know, there's no what we call Hashkacha Pratit. And the greatness of Purim is that below the surface, God is, so to speak, puppeting all these events. So the destruction of Vashti is going to lead to the what's it called, Gidul, how do you say, the
greatness of Esther.
The raising up of Esther, correct? The raising up, I don't know what word to use, and so forth and so on. So that's the great message of Emunah. From Rav Simcha Zissel's perspective, again, representing the Muslim movement, Emunah means faith which has to come through the intellect, which means that a person should be constantly aware of that faith, constantly involved in thinking about God. And that creates a training. Again, the best training ground, as we'll soon see, is prayer, because at that moment we're totally, exclusively focused on our faith in God, to the exclusion of any thoughts. So just to show you, I want to just illustrate to you a story about the Chose Milublin, who is a contemporary of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter.
Do they know one another?
I don't think so. They belong to two different movements.
Yeah.
In intellectual Jewish history. One is Chassidut, that's the Chose, and the other is the founder of the Musa movement. But yet, as I said at the outset, there's a tremendous overlap between these two movements. And I think it's illustrated by the following episode. Near the city of Lublin, where the Chose lived, and that's where he had all his disciples, there was a small Polish town. And in that town, I can't tell you the name of the town because I don't know the name of the town, but in that town, there were great rabbis, but there was one rabbi that was a tremendous scholar. And he used to give classes during the entire course of the year, and especially at the end of the year, when they got to the month of Elul, he would teach the most profound classes. And this would culminate in Rosh Hashanah. Now, of all the people in that town who used to attend his classes, there was one particular working man. His name was Chaim. And he was brilliant. And he worked very hard to attend the classes of this Rav, this great rabbi in the town in Poland. However, and this is what you have to know about this fellow Chaim, when it came time for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, he would pack his bags and he would go to the city of Lublin. And there, he would take a hotel room and stay for days and days on end. So the entire period of the High Holidays, from Rosh Hashanah till after Yom Kippur, he was next to and in the influence of the Chose of Lublin. And this went on year in and year out. And on one particular year, the Rav of the town came over to Chaim about 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah, and he said to him naively, "I assume you'll be with me for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur." So this Chaim says to the Rav, "I apologize, Rebbe, but I'm going to Lublin to be with the Chose." So for the first time after so many years, the Rav actually approached Chaim, you know, head on, so to speak, and he said to him, "I don't understand. Is it that you don't appreciate me? You don't appreciate my shiurim? Maybe they're not on the level that you have to leave me on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, the holiest days of the year, and pack your bags and leave to Lublin?" So immediately, even before the Rav could finish the sentence, Chaim said, "No, Rebbe, no, your shiurim are great, it's on the highest level. So then why do you leave our town and leave me every Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur to Lublin. So Chaim turns to the Rav and he says to him, the Chozen mi Lublin, the seer of Lublin, has one faculty that I've never seen, never experienced anywhere on the face of the earth. What's that? Says the Rav. He reads minds. He could tell you what you're thinking. And not only that, he says that even his disciples, who are close to him, by osmosis, they too pick up this uncanny ability of being able to read minds. So the Rav says to him, do you consider yourself, Chaim, a disciple of the Chozer? He says, of course. That's why I go every Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. So then, do you read minds? He says, of course I read minds. So he says to him, tell me then, what am I thinking right now? So without even blinking, Chaim turns to the Rav and he says, you're thinking about God. No, I wasn't thinking about God. That's why I go to the Chozer, because it's always thinking about God. It was a setup, if you follow
me.
This is the picture or the vision that we have of a giant in Judaism who has such a tremendous impact on his flock that he is able to get them to think about God. We go about our lives and we get distracted and we get involved in a million and one things. Even when we get up to pray, we get distracted and we're not able to focus on God. So our emunah takes, in a sense, a back seat. Having said that, let's take a look at the Beis HaTalmud, which was created by Rav Simcha Zissel of Broida. The page that I'd like you to have open in front of you, again, I don't know what you have and what you don't have, is page 176. And if you don't have it, then I'll fill you in on it. You do have it. Okay, so that's good news.
Oh, these are double sided.
Yeah. Now, this chapter begins on page 175. I don't know if you have that page as well.
Yeah, we should.
You should? Okay, great. That's good news. The chapter, which is chapter 15, in this book, which is called Tu'at HaMusar, from Rav Katz, is titled Beis HaTalmud HaGadol BeKelm, the great Beis HaTalmud of the city of Kelm. Okay. Now again, this was established by Rav Simcha Zissel, and it was his greatest educational creation, the enterprise of chinuch, as we said before, training. And Rav Simcha Zissel, as you can understand, would input all his energies, and it would reflect his ruach, his spirit. And he calls it Romemut Rucho. In other words, the lofty spirit of Rav Simcha Zissel. Rochav Dato, the broadness of his understanding. Not today, but next week in Mitzvah, we'll talk about secular studies, whether or not he allowed for secular studies. But again, Rochav Dato, a very broad kind of understanding. This institution, which is called Beit HaTalmud HaGadol Shebekelm, became what he calls Mofet HaOlam. It became institutionally the unique institution of all time, so to speak. And every little nook and cranny of this yeshiva, of this building, of this institution, of this program, would reflect the spirit of Rav Simcha Zissel. He says poetically, "Kol Evan, every stone would scream out the chinuch for emuna, the training for faith, for yira, for fear of God, for midot." Right? Remember last week we covered the chapter of Tikkun HaMidot, perfecting one's character. This would be ultimately the place in which, the house in which man would grow, he would mature, he would develop. And every single movement within this building would be considered weighty, shkula, kvua, it would be set. Every single step that you took was meant to be mechushav, was meant to be thought out. Mudrach, it's meant to be guided. It's a bayit, it's a building in which kol pniotav, wherever you turn, you would be uplifted by a spirit, an atmosphere that's suffused with splendor and sanctity. Now, if you take a look on the top of page 174, they tell the following story, that in a certain German university, the rector, there was a group of, principals or
the dean?
Trustees or deans, and they would gather together and make decisions for their institution. At one particular such meeting, one of the professors got up and he made the following statement. He says that there's one particular discipline, and if you want to understand how to train for that discipline, if you want to create an educational institution, then there's one such institution on the face of the earth. It's in a small town in Russia, and it's called Kelm. And that's where they teach you how to improve your character. In other words, even amongst the German scholars, there was an appreciation and a recognition for this unique institution called Beit HaTalmud Sheva Kelm. And in that time of history, there was a phrase called Talmud Torah. Talmud Torah means the study of Torah. And that, of course, was the essence of every yeshiva. Every yeshiva was a Talmud Torah. Again, for younger children, they actually called those yeshivot Talmud Torah. When they got to an older age, more mature, it was called a yeshiva. However, he says that what's unique about the Beit HaTalmud, that it gets its own name in Kelm, is that with regard to all other yeshivot, the goal was Talmud Torah, was get more and more Torah knowledge under your belt. Acquire more and more knowledge. Here, in the Beit HaTalmud of Kelm, there's an additional purpose, additional goal, and that is to study Torah within the atmosphere of minucha, of calm. You remember that Rav Simcha Zissel says the first enemy of man's avoda is pizur ha-nefesh. Here it's going to be minucha, and to train the students to be constantly aware of emunah, of faith. This means, and you can underline two words in the third paragraph that starts with ulam, the top line in that paragraph ends with two words, hishtalmut ishit, a perfection of one's personality. This is the ultimate agenda and the goal of the Beit HaTalmud in Kelm. Hishtalmut is going to make this a unique institution, because everything that happens within the walls of the institution is going to be geared towards hit'alut ruchanit, which is a phrase that we discussed at great length last week, which means a rise or an ascent up the spiritual ladder. We're no longer putting all the emphasis on the intellectual acquisition of knowledge, but rather on hishtalmut, hit'alut ruchanit. Now, let me ask you the following question. If you want to create such an atmosphere, then what is going to be your policy? And in two different areas, you're going to have to create a very strict policy. Can anybody guess which two areas I have in mind? Every institution of higher learning has to have what?
Expectations.
It works with a word that begins with a C. A curriculum. Excellent. And number two, you need what's called a policy of admission. So some of us here are interested in getting admitted to a law school, maybe a medical school, whatever is your occupation. And of course, any good institution that's worth its salt is going to have a policy of admission. If you want to create an institution on the highest level, you can't just have laissez-faire, open up the doors, and invite everyone. And therefore, we're going to have to work hard, says Rav Simcha Zissel, to create a curriculum that's appropriate, and its goal will be to achieve this perfection of Hitalut Ruchanit. Number two, we're going to have to look for people in our admissions policy who have what we call potential. Now, again, in a normal yeshiva, and I can tell you this from my experience, you know, I headed up a yeshiva, you have what's called IQ, which is intelligence quota. But here in Kelm, since the emphasis is not on, the goal is not, doesn't exhaust itself in the intellectual realm, instead of IQ, we're going to have RQ. We're going to have religious quota. We're going to need a potential for what's called Aliyah. Aliyah meaning ascension. We need people who are interested in ascending the ladder. Those are called Baalei Mala, which means these are people who want to perfect themselves. They want to achieve Hishtalmut Ishit. They are Baalei Midot Na'ot. They have proper behavior skills. And they have the potential. Again, we don't say that they're already perfect. If they're already perfect, they don't need to come into the Beit HaTalmud. Obviously, they have a distance to go. But if you wanted to get accepted to this Beit HaTalmud, you had to have credentials that proved and indicate that you had the potential to reach higher and higher levels in your Midot Tovot. And therefore, Rav Simcha Zissel would constantly be involved in what he calls Bikoret. And if you might find the word Bikoret here on the, I think it's the eighth line down, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, the seventh line down in this paragraph. Does anybody know, I mean, other than Rav Aaron, of course, but what, those who are here with me, do you know what the word Bikoret means in English? Are you familiar with that Hebrew word? It's a good word to know. I mean, they give me an extra salary here for Ulpan. So.
Is it related to like Yom HaBikurim?
No, that's with a Chav. Oh. This is Bikoret with a Kuf. Bikoret with a Kuf means Levaker, is to investigate, to criticize, to evaluate. There's going to be a constant sense of evaluation.
What page is this on, Rabbi?
Oh, I'm sorry. This is on page 176.
So it's almost like an ability to kibitz a little bit. Like, that's kind of like, or is it more positive than that?
In other words, what Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, Rabbi Simcha Zissel, as a Talmud of Rabbi Yisrael, he wants to make sure that the people who occupy places in this Beit HaTalmud will be constantly involved in Aliyah, in ascension. And therefore, in order to get accepted to this particular Beit HaTalmud, what you needed is recommendations from the various yeshivot. Now, there was an entire network of yeshivot already at this time that was founded by Rav Yisrael Salanter. These were called the Musar Yeshivot. And if you wanted to go up one step from the Musar Yeshivot to this Beit HaTalmud, then you have to produce credentials. You had to prove with documents and recommendations that you were ready for a very intense program. And what that means is that you were ready for, number one, tefillah. We'll see how intense the tefillah was in this Beit HaTalmud. You're going to flip out when you hear the details. Number two, l'shem limud. Again, the study of Torah, it was the Beit HaTalmud. And number three, hakshava l'sicha. Let's try to understand what that means. The word sicha here is, it could have been actually the title of this chapter. That's how important the word sicha is. Does anybody know what a sicha is? Okay, I'll give it to you in Yiddish. Let's say if anybody here knows the Yiddish. It's called a shmooze in Yiddish.
Yeah.
Have you heard of a shmooze?
Yeah, of course.
So the invention of what's called a musa shmooze dates back to the city of Kelm. Kelm was the Beit HaTalmud that invented the Sicha. And of course, who gave the Sicha? It was none other than Rav Simcha Zissel himself. This entire chapter is going to talk about the Sicha, the power of the Shmooz, of the Sicha. And it was a drasha on a whole different level than anything you and I ever experienced. That's why I say, if today the Beit HaTalmud exists, I would try to apply. I don't know if I'd have the credentials to get accepted, but it is just a phenomenal place. And you'll see in so many ways how unique it is in tefillah, in limud, and in sicha, in shmuzing. And in all these areas, there would be a tremendous hakpada. Hakpada means a demand for excellence with a bikoret. A bikoret means a constant evaluation. Not everyone would get accepted. And not only that, sometimes you were allowed to participate in one dimension of the program, but not in another dimension. So you may be up to it to come into the Beit HaTalmud for the Sabbath, but not for the weekdays, and so forth and so on. Everything in this institution was mitchila b'tzura kazu. It was all built in a way, the architecture and the structure in such a way that it was completely secluded. It's called segura. Okay, you used to have certain structures which are open from all sides. Here you had the opposite. And the impression you got when you saw the building, and certainly when you entered into it, is it's a very intense, closed environment. Kol ha'boel ha'bayit, anyone who entered the building of the Beit HaTalmud, hirgish, he immediately felt to who nimtza b'makom yuchad, he's in a unique environment, asher yirat kavod v'adrada kosh chofefet olav, he's completely enveloped by the fear and the awe of sanctity, of the dignity and glory of God. In this bayit, shararu starim kvuim, everyone had to be committed to certain specific hours of the program. He was not allowed to come late. He was not allowed to miss unless, again, there was a very extenuating circumstance. Once you came into the bounds of this building, you crossed the threshold, you had to act according to certain rules. And this was a very high-level program, very intense and very demanding. Now let's get down to some of the details. The bottom of page 176, going on to the top of page 177, he says that, again, this program was hishtalmut, was to strive for perfection. And in what areas would this express itself? Number one, machshava. As we said over and over again, the emphasis on thought, on intellect, on contemplation, on deep thought. Number two, tikkun aishi, is to work on myself, my personality, in order to ascend to higher levels of perfection of character. And the entire program was built and structured around this goal. And therefore, Rav Simcha Zissel Avikan Lidei Gilui at Kol Shitato, he used all his elements of his methodology and his belief in what Mussar is all about, anything that he inherited from his great Rebbe, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, and he put it all into the life of the Beit HaTalmud. How would an individual live inside the Beit HaTalmud according to the methodology of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter? That was the goal of the Beit HaTalmud of Kelm. Now, of course, the first element in the program, in the curriculum, is going to be Limud Musar. But here, the study of Musar would reach up to an ideal level. What does that mean? It would include two elements. Number one, Iyun, meaning to understand the nature of man. And number two, Shinun. Shinun means constant review. And we'll see exactly how Reb Simcha Zissel implemented this curriculum. With regard to Limud Iyuni, anyone would try to find time during the day to study new ideas. We'll get to the Sikha later, the Shmuz, but as far as the study itself, study new ideas in depth. But as far as the review, that was done together. All of the members of the Beit HaTalmud would have a set time in which they would engage in Shinun. And it took up as much as an hour a day. Usually, he said, the hour was right before Tfilat Arvit, before the third service of the evening, because this was going to be the culmination of the entire day. So for the entire day, from the moment I open my eyes, I dedicate myself towards towards this Musar approach, but it finally reaches culmination with that 1 hour before the end of the day when, as a group, we would study Musar. Now, this study had to require, if you remember the terminology that we spoke about Rabbi Yisrael, an impassioned speech. Do you remember that phrase?
Yes.
And that becomes critical for Rav Simcha Zissel, Hitla Vut So Eret. And this word So Eret is a very, very extreme or dramatic word. It really comes from the world of the sea when the ships would meet up with, unfortunately, a Sa'ara, which means a storm, and the waves would lift up the boat. And in the study of Musa for that 1 hour of the day, it had to be Hitlavut So Eret. In other words, an emotional, impassioned high. Kolot Nirgashim Ma'od. You could hear different people, you know, cry out with a very passionate kind of a call, a voice. And the echo of this 1 hour of the study of Musar with all the Hitlavut and all the Sara and all the Kol Nidrashim could be heard at a great distance. But at the same time, he said, nothing should be Chitzoni. In other words, very often you could have an outburst of energy or emotion that is external. You know, something triggers it off. Or for example, you can decide that you're going to move your hands and your body in this way or another body. That's not what we're talking about. Everything is directed towards lifnai v'lifnim. Now that phrase lifnai v'lifnim is borrowed by Rav Simcha Zissel from the Kohen Gadol, who once a year on Yom Kippur went lifnai v'lifnim into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And the lev, the heart of a person, is the lifnai v'lifnim. It's not just the pnim, it's not just the inner part of a person, but it's even the inner of the inner. It's the most sanctified area of the person. And that has to be the source for the hitlavut. All the emotion and the passion has to come from within. It's not something that's external. You understand? Here, again, this is just my own footnote, and I don't know if I'm right about this, but here I think Rav Simcha Zissel is parting ways with Chassidut. Because whereas Chassidut sees external kind of motions of the body and, you know, screams and yells and dancing and jumping and all that becomes a method to bring about an emotional change in a person. So you start with Chitzoni in order to achieve Pnimi. In the Musar movement, we have the exact opposite. Everything starts with the Pnim, within. And only those actions on the outside, which are reflective of the inside, are valid, are meaningful. So now we get to the point of Sa'arat HaLimud, this study of Musa with a great stormy emotional experience. And yesh, there were certain times when Rav Simcha Zissel, Bibakro B'etzem Le'ata, Adayin Lo Motzabat Shir Hitlavut HaDarush. He was unimpressed. He walked around the Beit HaTalmud and he thought that the level was not intense enough. And he would get up and criticize. That's called Limtoach Bikoret. Again, that word Bikoret. In which he said, this is not up to par. Where is the Chamimut? Where is the warmth, the fire? And where is the impassioned emotion? It's not there. On one particular occasion, when Rabbi Yisrael was disappointed, Rabbi Simcha Zissel was disappointed, he burst out and he said, "Ha'im kach mityachasim legazlan?" In other words, imagine if somebody was stealing something from you, would you just be passive about it? Again, today, you know, you're afraid to pull a gun on you, but I'm saying, in the old days, you know, you're not going to just turn around and say, "Okay, take my wallet." And his meaning was, in a symbolic sense, that the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, is about to jump on you and steal from you everything that you achieved on this very holy day. And all you can do is let the Yetzer Hara take over you. You should be bursting out against him. You should be fighting with passion. That was the mashal that he gave, the simile that he gave. Yesh ledaber ito, you should address the Yetzer Hara, b'tkifut rabah, with strong words. You should raise a zakat chamas, you no good thief that you tried to steal everything from me. Just like when a gazlan, a thief, pounces upon you. And therefore it was critical that on a daily basis that hour of Limud Musa would be so'er, would be stormy. And the stormy emotions would cleanse and a cathartic cleansing and purification of the souls and the hearts of man. Okay. Now we're up to the Sicha, to the Shmooz. Are you ready for this, Rav Osai? This is mind-boggling.
So this is like also just a, this is also what the Chofetz Chaim did. You said on his deathbed, he was arguing with Yetzer Hara.
Excellent. Not on his deathbed, but it was in his older age, and it was very freezing, cold out loud. So when he woke up in the morning to get up to davening, the Yetzer Hara started telling him, you're an old man, go back to sleep, under the warm blankets, the quilts, you know, and he was yelling and screaming at the Yetzer Hara, you're a gazlan, you're trying to steal from me, I'm not going to let you do it. Right. Now we get to the shmooz. Yeah, Jackie.
So the constant review, you're not reviewing what you just learned during the previous day, you're learning Musar specifically.
Right, okay. Right. Okay, now we get to the Sicha, the shmooz. This is on the bottom of page 177, a paragraph that starts L'tochnit. So now a major part of the curriculum was the shmooz of Reb Simcha Zissel. And you and I would think that perhaps he got up in front of the whole Beit HaTalmud once a week, once a month, for an hour here, an hour there. Well, I got news for you, that's not exactly what went on. In Rabbi Simcha Zissel's program, the Sicha was a major instrument of Mashpia. Do you see? You see the second line in the paragraph L'Tochnit? Do you see that word in the first word, mashpiot? Mm-hmm. Have you heard of mashpia? For example, Lubavitch, they have something called a mashpia. They don't even call him a mashkiach. Because a mashkiach is someone who just looks around and he supervises, makes sure everyone is behaving properly, shows up on time, he's dressed properly. But a mashpia is a much more profound role. Sam, do you have any connection to Chabad?
Yeah.
You do. Did you ever hear the phrase mashpia?
Yeah.
Yeah, a mashpia. I spent the summer in Kfar Chabad.
Wait, can you explain though? Because I don't understand everything.
I'll try to explain.
Brusselers also have it. I don't.
Okay. Brusselers got it from Chabad. No, I'm just kidding. No politics here. But in Chabad, they have something called a mashpia. The mashpia is someone who has an impact on another person. And the official mashpia is a reference to single out one person who has the most hashpah, the most influence on the people in the yeshiva. So in a sense, the highest position in a Chabad yeshiva is the mashpia. He's almost higher than the Rosh Yeshiva. Even the Rosh Yeshiva himself may be more of an intellect, but he doesn't play that role necessarily in the mashpia. So you have this intellectual giant, but to some extent he's a little bit alienated a certain distance from the students, because the students stare in awe on him because they know how brilliant he is. But then you have the mashpia, and the mashpia is someone who excites you. He arouses your feelings towards Yiddishkeit, towards Judaism.
So because of the emphasis on Kiruv, is that why?
I didn't hear you.
Is that because the reason, is that why it's so important within Chabad in particular, maybe also Breslov?
I would say it the other way around. I would say it this way, that since Chabad is built around the Mashpia, it was natural almost for Chabad to take over the role of Kiruv, because the infrastructure was there. But it's not that, you know, because of Kiruv they became Mashpiyim. It doesn't go like that. It goes the other way around. Within the Chabad Yeshiva network, which is called Tomchei Tmimim, when my father told me in his youth, you know, back in Lithuania, when you reached a certain age, usually around 16, then they sent you off to Tomchei Tmimim, which was the center Yeshiva in Lubavitch, and that's where you came in contact with the Mashpia. Rav Simcha Zissel, and now we're shifting back to the Muslim movement, he became, in his Kelm Yeshiva, the Mashpia, and look at how he describes him. His Hashpa'ah, his impact, was B'midah Bilti Mishu'eret. In other words, there are no words that we could describe the measure of his impact on his students. Hu haya doresh b'musar sichot arukot ma'od. L'famim ad kidei shtayim o shalosh shahot b'tzufot. The famous shmooz of Rav Simcha Zissel would last for 2 and 3 hours. V'yesh, and sometimes, asher hayah nosei sichot ke'elu kama pamim biyom. Do you hear this, my friends? You know, it's Rav Simcha Zissel, I'm just imagining, would come into the Beit HaMidrash, he would bang on the table and get up there and give a shmooze. And this would happen a number of times within one day. B'Shabbatot, during the course of Shabbos, he was a scholar in residence, and he would lecture 3 times over the course of Shabbos. On Friday night, between Kabbal Shabbos and Ma'ariv, in Shacharis, and then at twilight before the end of Shabbos. Lamrod Shefa Dvarim Hayu HaTalmidim Akshivim Lehem B'Tshuka Lo Hetet. According to this description, again, you could be cynical if you don't want to accept this description, but Dov Katz claims that the fellows in the yeshiva never got bored, even despite the long hours of the shmuzim. They never said, Ravli, I'm getting too much. On the contrary, they always felt they weren't getting enough. In these shmuzim, Rav Simcha Zissel would analyze. Those are called iunit. And it was full of content, new ideas that were very deep and very profound in all areas of thought, in all analysis of kochot ha-nefesh, of the human psyche. What does that sound like to you, this emphasis on insight into the human psyche?
Psychology,
and who does that sound like that we've been discussing for the last 3 months?
Salanter.
Exactly, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. I once mentioned to you that there are those who believe, and again, you know, you could always be cynical about this comment, that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was more profound of a psychologist than Sigmund Freud. Hence you have Hillel Goldberg's book, which I couldn't understand. So I finally returned it to its owner, because it's all full of psychological terminology that, you know, if you had a PhD in psychology, I don't think you'd understand. That's why Rabbi Sol Salanter's writings are so difficult, so challenging.
Could Freud have been influenced by that area of study?
I have no doubt that he was, but not directly, but indirectly.
Yeah, indirectly, yeah.
So now we're going to turn to page 178, and again we see on the top of the page the word Hitlavut. And the goal of the shmooze was hit or root, was to awaken the person to become more aware of himself, of his own challenges, and this was the approach. Now, as I indicated to you before, what would be the pinnacle in terms of the calendar year of the curriculum of shmoozim, of sichot? It would be Elul and Yomim Noraim. The entire year was sort of structured around a hub. The hub, or the pinnacle, it's like climbing Mount Everest, would be on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Hayuri Gilim B'Yishivot L'shtamesh L'shem Hashpa'a B'Dvarim Kvushim Ma'orim U'malhivim. This was a perfect time that was ripe for awakening people's feelings with strong, harsh words. And Rav Simcha Zissel would bring the people to crying, dmos, and bechi. And despite the fact that the people were crying, Rav Simcha Zissel would continue in his way. And again, everything was analytic, as we said before, derech higayon, with logic, and machshava, and thought. Lo chasru kimuvan gam tviot kifot ubikoret nokevet al tahom ad tahom anefesh. Very often, Rav Simcha Zissel would critique a person, not publicly rank out a person and by name, but in terms of what the impact of and the direction of his shmooze was very takif. He would be very strong, very harsh. Sometimes it brought the person to the brink of complete breakdown, because Rabbi Simcha Zissel would picture in front of his eyes how lacking he was, you know, how deficient he was. And as I told you many, many times, Rav Chaim Brisker was opposed to the Musa movement for this very reason, because Rav Chaim Brisker, in his yeshiva in Valozhin, he felt that there's no mitzvah to bring a person to a breakdown. Adrava, where the contrary is true, we want to bring a person to an elevated state of joy and gladness and self and self-esteem. However, in this particular Beit HaTalmud, especially on the at the time periods of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, which are the days of judgment, it was critical to bring the people from this state of Iyun to a Cheshbon HaNefesh. And that's a phrase that you have to learn by heart. Does everybody here know what Cheshbon HaNefesh means?
Accounting of the soul.
Excellent. To a self evaluation. You'll see it, and you should highlight it with every color in the rainbow. It's three lines up before the end of this paragraph. Cheshbon HaNefesh. Choder. It's got to penetrate into your soul and be ready to look at your soul in all honesty and evaluate it. Now here, Rav Katz uses a phrase which I'm not familiar with. I'm going to try to see if I can do the best I can. And he uses it over and over again from here on to the end of the chapter, called Tzirim Nirchavim. What I think he means, again, take this with a grain of salt, because I have no, you know, I can't call up the man and ask him. He's in a, it's a long distance phone call, if you know what I mean. And he, I think what he means is that the method of the shmooze was to create something picturesque, something that you could see in the apple in your eye. You know, in other words, not see in a physical sense, but it had to be very dramatic, very colorful. It had to be something that you could almost imagine with your mind. And he used to use this method of Tziurim Nirchavim in order to transmit the nature of punishment for sin and reward for mitzvah. Okay, so we'll try to see if we can flesh out this idea of Tziurim Nirchavim as we go through this chapter. Now, in order to create Tziurim Nirchavim, which means, you know, you've got to use your imagination and to draw a picture of, you know, use words to draw a picture, you needed a certain talent. Rav Simcha Zissel had that talent. He had that endowment in more than a normal measure. He was able to explain and picture and give you a picture, depict the kochos hanefesh, the character traits of a person. And very often, in order to dramatize this, he would picture in front of them, present in front of them, in his shmuzim, tipusim chayim. He would give living examples. Again, without embarrassing anybody. When we say living examples, I don't think we mean that he would call someone by name. And he would try to show and demonstrate what midot, what characteristics can do, both on the positive and on the negative side, by drawing these pictures in front of them, drawing these tzirim nirchavim.
So it'd be like a mashal about maybe a particular person's deficiencies, but it was not about them particularly?
Right. He would talk in general terms, not about somebody specific, but he would draw pictures in front of you of faith, of fear of God, of developing the intellect, of learning how to focus and not be distracted, on how to improve your character's traits, how to control your yetzer hara. All these aspects would be very powerfully depicted in the shmuzim. Now the shmuzim were organized based on a program, a syllabus that was engineered up front, because the curriculum was built in a way of minakal el akaved. This is the paragraph that starts the word hasichot. What does it mean, minakal el akaved? He gives an example of a physician. A physician is not going to zap you with the most powerful drug at the first stage. He's going to try to use, you know, lower ebb drugs that are not so aggressive, and then finally, if need be, he'll develop it and upgrade, you know, intensify the dosage or the type of drug he's using. In the Nimshal, he's saying that the shmuzim of Rav Simcha Zissel belonged to a curriculum in which they would gradually gradually go from less intense to more heavy kind of schmoozing. And every single schmooze had nekudah mesuyev, it had one point that was critical. Now listen to this. This is at the end of the paragraph, Asichot. Mishena nedar, if somebody missed a sicha, a shmooze, he realized immediately that something was lacking in himself. Because every single shmooze was part of a program that took you from point X to point Z in a gradual... So he quotes somebody by the name of Rav Tzvi Breuder. I don't know who he was. I suspect that he was from the family of the Kelma Magid. And he complained that on one occasion he missed the shmooze, and that shmooze was the introduction to faith. And as a result, his faith was never the same. All because he missed that one shmooze. Now today, of course, you have recordings, right? And you and I say, well, I don't have to be there. You know, let Rav Simchler Zissel talk into the microphone and we'll record it. And I'll listen to the recording on YU Torah or whatever your favorite site is. But it doesn't work like that because there was a one-on-one experience. Even though Rav Simchler Zissel was addressing an entire audience, every single person felt that he was being touched individually and personally by the words of Rav Simchler Zissel. Rav Simchler Zissel often would evaluate his own sichot. He would say, my shmooze is l'chadesh ruach acheret ba'adam. My goal is to instill within man a brand new spirit. Lasot lev chadash, to create a new heart. V'ruach chadashan, a new spirit. Laskil, lehitiv, lechabev, torah v'yirah v'divrei chazal. It would instill in a person an understanding, an appreciation, a love, and a cherishing for the Torah, and for the fear of God, and for all the words of our great rabbis. Sometimes he would say, his pilus means out of a state of amazement, he would say, he says, if you would take this last presentation that I gave, Yachtu Giborim Ashalibam Kalev Arayos. He says that even the great Giborim, you know, the mighty who have, you know, they're like lions, Yitporu, they would fall apart, they would crumble in front of your eyes. Anakim Rifaim, even great giants, right? What are they called when they're you know, they're many times more than human size? Is that called the giant? What is a better word for that? Anyway, it's called Anakim, like Emek Rifaim. And these were people whose lev was Yimas Kadonak, meaning that Rav Simchler Zissel would give himself a pat on the back, and he would say that my shmuzim sometimes are so powerful, they can take a hard heart, you know, somebody who thinks he's mighty, and melt it. And he used other expressions that were similar.
They're called refined, like giants, like Og, kind of like Rav.
Yeah. These, you know, he uses that mushal of an Og Melech HaBashan, who has the most powerful body and heart, and yet he would just melt because of the way that Rav Simchler Zissel was able to touch a person's heart in the shmuzin. I mean, again, I would give $1,000, if not more, just to hear one of these shmuzin. It sounds like it was a different experience, a different world. Now, what about somebody who wanted to show up for the shmooze? He wasn't part of the yeshiva. And he would say, can I come? So he says, l'achirim, for those who weren't part of the curriculum, they weren't, you know, registered students, what are they called, matriculated students, lo natnu bo driset regel. He would not allow them to come in. Because they would take it for granted. You know, they would see it as insignificant. They didn't realize that this was the apex. You know, sometimes you can hear a lecture and, you know, you sit back on two legs of the chair and you say, okay, yeah, very nice, but you're not impressed with it because you don't realize the nuances. You're not part of the entire project, part of the entire enterprise. And therefore, he said that the shmooze would not have an impact on such a person. Sometimes he would tell certain talmidim, don't come to the shmooze. you're going to come to a different shmooze, because he understood which Talmud, which student was meant to hear which shmooze. And then there were certain shmuzim that he would only give, they were exclusive for Mitzuyanim Biyoter, only the top people in the Beit HaTalmud. Leprakim, sometimes he had Doresh Tashlum B'Mechir. He wanted to give people a sense of value to treat the shmuz on the highest level. So he would charge them for that. Sometimes he would charge them a lot of money, shlosha ruble. I don't know, 3 rubles doesn't sound like that much money, but I guess, you know, it's all relative to where you are. And all this would instill in a person, you know, like for example today, let's say, imagine the psychology, you have 2 lectures to go to, and let's say you went to both of them. One was free of charge, you know, they write on the bottom of the flyer, it says no, you know, no cost or whatever they write. And another one is going to cost you money. When do you pay more attention? You know, if you pay money, you gotta get your money's worth.
It's true in economics. People tend to not treat as well the things that are free. They you know, commoditize them to the point where they don't have value.
So they take it for granted.
Treat like it doesn't have value.
He says, "Lerov hayagam roshem shasichot v'sholeh roshem." Excuse me. He would write down a summary of his lecture. Sholeh hatakot mehem lekrovav unemekuravav. Now again, I don't know exactly what he means by hatakot. You know, we're talking about the year 1890. I don't know if they had the photocopy machines, but he says, I guess he would copy it over many times, and he would send it to his krovim, as his relatives, or mekurov, of his best students. V'yesh asher aya roshem b'shulei adaf tochit palut shamar. He says, sometimes, I guess we have such documents, I don't know if they're in a museum somewhere, where he would write on the outside, that's called on the shulayim, what's it called in English? The margin. On the margin, right? On the margins, mavhil arayon. That this idea that I'm telling you is unbelievably powerful. Or he would write morer yishenim. It wakes up the dead. Vakol kedei larim erkam ulagdil tashpatam. This was all meant to elevate the estimation of a person of the shmuz, so that he would be influenced by the shmuz. And he says that we cannot even begin to evaluate how much of an impact these shmuzim would have on the people. He says, "Balei nisayon misaprim." Those who experienced those shmuzim relate that b'meshach shavuot achadim, for weeks and weeks after the shmuz, nefchu l'anashim achirim, they were transformed in their very personality, in their hashkafa, in their veltanshan, in their rikshoheim, in their emotions. And now we get to the third element in the curriculum of the Beit HaTalmud. Until now we were speaking about the hour a day of Musar and its impact. We're speaking about the Shmuzim, which sometimes would last hours and hours a day. Now we get to Tefillah, prayer. Now I davened in the Shtiblach here. I don't know if you've ever davened in the Shtiblach. Then just try out the 6 a.m. minyan. And if you come 15 minutes early, maybe you'll catch up to them.
Usually we have a Kabbalat Shabbat there. It's right near where I live.
Oh, maybe Kabbalat Shabbat is a little different. I don't know. But the 6 a.m. minyan, if you blink, it's over. Now, how long did they daven in the Beit HaTalmud of Kelm? He says the following. First of all, you have to appreciate that the value of tefillah, the significance of tefillah, of prayer, is not just supplication to God. It's not just an opportunity to ask God for whatever you need, but moreover, it's an opportunity for the development of one's spirituality in a very comprehensive way. Number one, hitraksut hamachshava, to train a person to focus. Number two, this is, by the way, before they had Ritalin, lehalavat haregesh, right? To arouse one's feelings. Number three, hitbonenut bepilei habriya. You remember we spoke about Rav Simcha Zissel's appreciation of nature, of the greatness of God in the creation. And finally, and this is perhaps the apex of what tefillah is all about, lahadbarat ha'emunah v'bitachon, to intensify one's belief, one's faith, and reliance upon God, to understand that that a person could achieve from God through prayer, Chazdei Hashem, that God would bestow upon him all the goodness, his ability to continue in life, to wake up the next morning and still be alive and breathe. All that appreciation came through tefillah. And therefore, tefillah plays the central role in the curriculum of the Beit HaTalmud of Kelm. We're going to learn later on, he's giving us just a preview about various takanot, very special takanot, that's at the end of this chapter, we didn't even photocopy those pages, various requirements of tefillah in terms of seder, in terms of how it was organized, and punctuality. But besides that, yichdu la tsumat lev rava, there was a tremendous emphasis on hitamkut hamachshava, on focusing on deep, deep thought. It's almost like, you know, Rabbi Kaplan has a chapter in his book, no, he has a whole book actually, on Jewish meditation. You familiar with that?
Yeah.
This is the overlap between Rav Aryeh Kaplan, Zichron Levracha, and Rav Simcha Zissel. I don't know, honestly, historically, but I could bet my bottom dollar that Rav Aryeh Kaplan was definitely influenced by Rav Simcha Zissel. Mm. Because of this emphasis on contemplation, on meditation, on sharpening one's ability to think in the deepest, most profound way, on being ma'or, the regesh, on generating feelings. Shalosh ha-tfilot. There were three tfilot every day, and they took, underline the next word, sha'ot achadot.
Where is this?
Okay, if you're counting from the bottom of page 179, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines up, you see the word achadot?
Yeah.
And the word before that is sha'ot.
Okay, got it.
Sha'ot achadot, a number of hours. My gosh. I would tell you that the if I daven in the shtibel at 6 and then I show up for Mincha Ma'ariv, the total of all those three tefillot is less than an hour. Less than an hour. He's talking about sha'ot achadot. Sherikzubahen et kol maloha hityanyunut. And all the focus of energy would be placed on these hours of tefillot. Omnam, lo echshivu et ribuya tefillot v'mizmarot. They didn't consider it as if it was too many or too long. Naktu et haklal, on the contrary, this is what the students in the Beit HaTalmud used to say, tov ma'at ubekavana. Halavai, they would say that even in part of the tefillah, you know, it's a certain segment of that time that was dedicated for prayer, would be with intensity of feeling, of intention, of kavanah. And within the context of prayer, yardu ba, they went down la'omka, into its very depths. They were able to be mechadish, to come up with new ideas, many, many new ideas, which they would use and implement in the Musar of the day. Hatfilaita itit ma'od. The prayers were very slow. Kim'at kimonemat be'ot. Like if you were counting coins and you want to make sure you have enough, you know, how much money do you have? You count them one by one. Levavit, with a tremendous amount of emotion. Chadura machshavot. They were completely penetrated with thought. Urigashot nilhavim. And tremendous emotional energy. And Rav Simcha Zissel would demand of each one of them that he would connect various ideas to the psukim, the verses that were part of the tefillah. You know, as you just didn't read the verses of tefillah, like for example, Psukei Dezimra is all verses from Tehillim, from the book of Psalms. You would have to attach to every single verse a certain idea. V'odot lezeh, we're on the top of page 180, Yeshnam, this is the way you could review your ideas, by attaching them to the verses. And by the way, you should know that in Chabad they have the same philosophy. In Chabad, if you ever sit next to a student in the Chabad Yeshiva, in Tomchei Tmimim, like in Kfar Chabad, have you ever had that experience? Where you're like 15 pages ahead of him, and he's still stuck on Hodu.
Yeah.
And you think to yourself, yeah. Hodu, my gosh, what is he thinking about for an hour on Hodu? And the answer is that every single word of Hodu triggers off in his mind another philosophical idea about divinity, about his relationship to God, about his midos. And therefore tefillah has to serve as luach mafteach l'kama rayonot. You know, just like you have, you know, you have like a billboard and you attach little pieces of paper and each one you write a little note on it, you know, a few words. He says every single part of the tefillah was like a billboard. You know, you attach to that part a little note about what you should be thinking about. But all this reaches its apex during the period of time called Elul and Yemei Hatshuva. So that's on the top of page 180. I don't think you have page 180. So we'll stop here. And maybe I could ask Jackie if you want to volunteer. I can't force you. But if you can photocopy from page 180, I think what I have here, actually I don't know where the pages disappeared, so I guess I'll just leave you the book, but I think I had the pages somewhere.
Right there.
Could it be here? Oh, wait. Yeah, how do you like that? So this is what I'd like you to photocopy, double side for next week in Ritz Hashem. And that'll be our post-Purim learning about Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. So it's as if we have Purim behind us next Monday and we're already preparing for Yom Kippurim. And I want to take this opportunity to wish everyone a fabulous, fabulous Purim. And we have a real challenge. It's a Friday Purim here in Yerushalayim. That's always a challenging Purim. Because you can't get too carried away because you have to go to Shabbos with some sort of a brain on you, on your shoulders. But nevertheless, it's a wonderful, incredible opportunity. Could have an impact on the entire year to come. So my blessings to you, my wishes for you are that this Purim should be a most, if not the most powerful Purim in your life. Ken Yeratzon. And don't forget, Shivisi Hashem Lenegdi Sovi. He was always thinking about God.